Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Ribenis, and as always, I appreciate you tuning in. I am very pleased to have as my guest today award-winning historian Mary Beth Norton, author of In the Devil's Snare, The Salem Witchcraft Crisis of 1692. It was named a Best Book of the Year by the Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, and Newsday. She is a professor of American history at Cornell University. Great to have you here with me. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm glad to be here and to talk about witchcraft. Always happy to have that discussion.
Sure. So these events that you write about are such iconic ones in American history. Some would argue mythological. There is an entire tourism industry built off of the Salem witch trials. When you first decided to tackle this subject, how did you envision it standing out amongst all of the noise?
Well, I decided that I needed to write a book about Salem witchcraft. I was quite reluctant, actually, to do it. But my own work is on, or has focused on, gender and politics in the colonial period for a number of years. This is the Salem witchcraft book is just one of a series of four books that all address that issue in different time periods and in different contexts. And I realized that since I wanted to write about the late 17th century, I couldn't write about the late 17th century without writing about Salem witchcraft, which is the elephant in the room if you're thinking about that period. So as I approached the book, I thought what would make it stand out from the others is the previous book that I had finished called Founding Mothers and Fathers, which is based on 17th century court records, mostly about 6,000 court cases. And I thought to myself, as I approached the task of working on Salem witchcraft, was that I was the only person who'd ever written about Salem witchcraft who'd read 6,000 other 17th century court cases first. Even legal historians had not read as extensively in 17th century court cases as I had. So I thought that I understood certain things about the dynamics of the 17th century courtroom, also how women were treated in the 17th century courtroom that other people wouldn't have known. And so I had a fair amount of confidence that I would be able to turn up new things when I looked at the topic. And that, in fact, turned out to be the case. For example, one of the things I learned when I did Founding Mothers and Fathers was that when young women came into courtrooms, they were rarely believed when they made accusations, especially against powerful men, but against anybody, really. They were often disbelieved. the courts did not pay a lot of attention to them, did not pay a lot of attention to their complaints. So here in the case of Salem, we have a situation in which there's a group of young women who claim to be bewitched and who are presenting accusations against large numbers of people, and they are believed. And so that raised the question in my mind, why are they believed? Why is this so different from other 17th century court cases? And that's a question that nobody had ever asked before.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question for sure. So most of us know these historical events as the Salem Witch Trials, but you chose a different word instead. You call this the Salem Witchcraft Crisis. Why crisis?
Thank you for picking up on that. I thought that too many of the previous books about Salem witchcraft had focused specifically on trials. That is, the legal procedures when people were called before the court of Oyer and Terminer. They did not focus on the wider context of what was going on and about, for example, accusations that were made but never pursued in court. And I thought that it was important to cast my net for evidence as widely as possible and to look at anything I could find, frankly, from the late 17th century. So, for example, one of the things I did was to go to manuscript libraries and look at as many letters as I could find that were written in the period that didn't necessarily have anything to do with witchcraft, but just so that I could get a sense of the context of the times. And the use of the word crisis in my title is actually very deliberate.
Interesting. So let's set the scene, if you don't mind, before we get into the nuts and bolts of the crisis. Could you talk about what life was like in Essex County, Massachusetts during this period? What were some of the issues residents of the county were dealing with in the early 1690s?
Well, one of the big issues that people were dealing with was Indian Wars, the aftermath of King Philip's War, which was probably the most destructive war in American history in terms of the losses of population and property. And that was a war that was started in the mid-1670s in southern New England and spread to northern New England and ended finally in 1678 with a truce that didn't last all that long. And then war started again in 1688. So war was an ever-present consideration for people in northern New England at this time. There were militia troops, there were forts that came under attack and so forth. And so people had a lot of involvement in these Indian wars. So that's a major thing. Another major thing was that the Charter of Massachusetts had been thrown out, the previous Charter of Massachusetts had been abrogated by the authorities in England. And so Massachusetts was without a formal, I wouldn't say without a government, but it was with a kind of a jerry-built government until the new charter was issued. The Massachusetts colony had sent a delegation to England to negotiate for a new charter. One of those was the prominent minister, Increase Mather, and there were others who had gone with him. And they spent months in London discussing with the Privy Council and the king what would happen with the Massachusetts government. In the end, they did win a new charter, which was adopted in England in 1691 and returned to Massachusetts with the new charter, basically after things had started with the initial accusations and so forth. So I would say that the two major considerations or contextual considerations in the political military realm that affected northern New England at the time of the crisis were the Indian Wars and the lack of a charter. Also, of course, it was the middle of the winter, and winters were cold, and people were cooped up, small houses with large families, and there must have been a lot of just plain old friction going on in these households.
Yeah, for sure. And could you enlighten us on the role that religion played in day-to-day existence in this community?
Well, it depended. When you say this community, it was different in different communities. One of the things that is not widely known today is that everything started in the place called Salem Village, which is an outlying area of Salem Town. It is today the town of Danvers, Massachusetts, not the city of Salem. And the religious situation in Salem Village was particularly fraught. One of the key issues always ongoing in 17th century New England was that people were required to attend church legally, whether or not they were members of the church. Everyone was supposed to go to church on Sundays, and sometimes during the middle of the week also. That was part of the law of the colony. And the churches that they were attending were Puritan churches. Now, when people moved to outlying areas of any settlement, it was difficult to travel always on Sundays to get to church. And so what often happened was what happened in Salem Village is that the people who lived out there, when there was a cluster of them, began to petition to set up their own church. Salem Town resisted this for a long time, but finally, in the 1680s, they agreed that Salem Village could have its own church, a kind of a satellite of the church in Salem Town. But Salem villagers were deeply divided about choosing a minister. It was up to Puritans who lived in these villages to decide who their ministers would be. Because there was no church hierarchy. They just recruited people and interviewed them, as it were, and listened to their sermons for a few weeks or months, and then decided whether they wanted to hire these people as these guys as their ministers. Well, Salem Village for years had been unable to hit upon a minister that it liked very well. There were several who went in and out in short periods of time, a year or two. But finally, in the late 1680s, they found the Reverend Samuel Parris, who had been a Harvard student, but had gone to the West Indies because his father owned a plantation there, and he was his father's heir, and he inherited some property, and then he came back to Massachusetts, and he tried to be a merchant in Boston, did not succeed very well, but he was recruited by Salem Village to be their minister, and he was finally ordained, which was the crucial event. None of the previous ministers who served in Salem Village had been formally ordained, and that meant they could not serve the Lord's Supper. They could not baptize children. Samuel Parris was ordained, so he could do those things, but he had a very rigid view of the church and who could be members. And he set up rigid procedures for people to apply to be members of the church. And only members of the church, as I said, could have their children baptized or could partake of the Lord's Supper. So there was a lot of friction in Salem Village around the church. Think about it. Everybody was required to come to church, but once a month at the time of the service of communion, most of the people in the church would have to leave while the elect, that is the people who had been chosen to be church members, who had passed his rigid qualifications for being members, were able to stay behind to take communion and to have their children baptized. As you can well imagine, this led to a lot of friction in the town.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So when this story is told in film and television, it often begins with the girls that would become afflicted, these eventual accusers, participating in a fortune-telling circle. But you dispel this myth in your book pretty quickly.
There's actually no contemporary evidence of a fortune-telling circle of girls. Zero. That's a myth that was created later. What there is, and certainly there's no evidence of a fortune-telling circle with Tituba, the slave in the Parris household. Also, Tituba is clearly an American Indian. She is not of African descent. People in Salem in the 1690s knew well the distinction between American Indians and people of African descent. There were actually two women who are caught up in accusations in the Salem witchcraft trials who are themselves slaves of African descent, and they are clearly identified that way in the record. Tituba was an Indian. There is a dispute about where she came from and what was her background, but she's clearly an Indian. She is always called an Indian in the records. She's always called Tituba Indian, or simply Tituba. And there's no evidence whatsoever that she was anything other than a slave in the household of Samuel Parris, that she did any fortune-telling of any sort, any conjuring, and so forth, except in one instance when she did a test for a witch at the direction of a woman in Salem Village. There's no evidence of anything else. And there's no evidence of the girls themselves doing anything. We talk about the afflicted girls as though it was a unified group. But in fact, at the time, they're referred to in different sections. That is, there are the quote, the children. There are three of them. They're 12, 11, and 9, or even younger. And then there are the teenagers and 20-somethings. Now, if we think about today, how often do older teenagers hang out with 10-year-olds? I mean, it just wouldn't have happened. This is not the sort of thing that went on. And the children who were the initial afflicted in Salem Village did not associate so much with the older girls. The older young women were the ones who were doing some fortune telling, at least individually. We know that a couple of them did individual fortune telling, try to find out their futures, who their husbands would be, and so forth. It's pretty typical in that day and age for older teenagers. But there's no evidence that they did so as a group, and there's no evidence that any of this had anything to do with the beginnings of what went on in Salem Village. Zero. No contemporary evidence.
A teenage girl playing around, guessing who her future husband might be, I mean, that happens now.
Yeah.
But this was more taboo, wasn't it, in 1692, with this puritanical belief system kind of looming in the background?
It depended. As far as the ministers were concerned, fortune telling meant going to the devil, and so it was something that was forbidden. As far as ordinary people were concerned, fortune telling was something they did. You know, they would go to people who were seen as people who could see into the future. This is both men and women who get, by the way, caught up in the Salem trials as accused. And the ordinary people saw no problem with fortune telling. It was the ministers who excoriated it and said it was that fortune telling had to come from the devil. Their argument went as follows. God would never tell you the future. So if you were looking to find the future, you had to learn it from the devil. You couldn't find it from God. And therefore, it was forbidden.
So the Reverend Samuel Parris, whom you've already mentioned, begins preaching a series of sermons in November of 1691. Do you believe that these sermons served as a catalyst for things to come?
Well, we are fortunate that his sermon notebook has survived, and so we can read his sermons. And it does seem as though, and he's very angry with the community because of the friction that I talked about earlier. People have stopped paying his salary. People who disagreed with him have stopped paying his salary, and they've stopped supplying him with firewood. Now, think about that. Here it is, the dead of winter in Salem Village, and he's not getting the firewood he's supposed to be getting from his congregation. So he gets angrier and angrier, and the sermons get louder and louder. One assumes, you can't tell from the printed page or the written page what they were, how he delivered them, but the words become more and more censorious of the surroundings and of the people. And yes, I think it's definitely possible that his sermons, listened to by impressionable young girls who lived in his household, his daughter, his niece, who were the first two that were affected, could very well have helped to bring on their afflictions. I might add that one of the things that I did in my book was to examine the history of similar afflictions in England to see what happened, see if there were patterns. And indeed, there is a pattern of impressionable young children in intensely Puritan households earlier in the 17th century in England and actually in other colonies becoming afflicted in various ways and having those afflictions diagnosed by local physicians as witchcraft.
What were those afflictions? What were their symptoms?
They varied in the other cases, and in this they all varied, but it would included things like being struck dumb, engaging in peculiar physical activities. Like, for example, Paris's niece is said to have flown around the room, quote unquote, flapping her arms and threatening to jump into the fire. So she had to be restrained physically from jumping into the fire. Another thing is said is that they crept under furniture. Sometimes they refused to eat. There were a whole variety of things. Sometimes they said they were being pricked by invisible pins. Just a whole variety of strange behaviors that led Samuel Paris first actually to do what a good minister should have done in those periods, which was to call on neighboring ministers to come to pray and fast on behalf of the children in his household. When that didn't work, he then called in the local doctor, and the local doctor diagnosed witchcraft.
How did things progress from there? Who were the first to be accused as witches?
We know that the afflictions began in the middle of January of 1692. But the first accusations, the first formal accusations by the children did not come until the end of February. So that was 6 weeks. And it's hard to know exactly what happened after the diagnosis of witchcraft, or even how long the praying took before the doctor diagnosed witchcraft. And we don't know what kind of interrogation the children were subjected to in that period. I mean, we know later on that people who were accusers said they were interrogated by magistrates and ministers and so forth as to who was afflicting them. But we don't actually know what went on in that really crucial period. There's nobody who talks about it anywhere in the record. But you asked who the first people accused are. There's three of them. There's Tituba, who was, of course, known to the accusers. And there are two other women in the town, both of whom had poor reputations, although for somewhat different reasons. One was a woman in her late 30s who was impoverished, but who had been raised with more resources than she had now. And she was known for sort of going begging from house to house. And another was an older woman who had scandalized the community by after her husband died, marrying her quite young male indentured servant. Those were the first three people accused.
And they were Sarah Good and Sarah Osborne, right?
That's right. Sarah Good is the impoverished person, and Sarah Osborne is the older woman who scandalized the community. So Good and Osborne were women of poor reputations, and Tituba was well known, of course, to the initial accusers because they were in her, she lived with them in their household. And one of the possible speculations is, and it's only a possible speculation, is because she is known to be an Indian, and because, as I said, there were Indian wars going on at the time, that she fell under particular suspicion because of her ethnicity.
And how did these three women individually react to being accused of practicing witchcraft?
Well, Tituba was the first one who was questioned, and she was a slave. She knew what to do. She knew to confess. She knew to agree with anything that the magistrates and ministers said. So she confessed to being a witch, and she named the other two as her accomplices, and she elaborated in various ways. She said there were more witches. She claimed there were familiars, animal familiars, who were working with the witches to bring them the messages from the devil. This was one of the English stories about witchcraft, is that there were little creatures, birds or rats or mice or something else would bring would bring messages from the devil to the witches. And so she elaborated, she created this huge elaborate thing of, there was a red cat, there were, you know, there was this and that, there were yellow birds. She talked wildly about all these things. When Sarah Good and Sarah Osborne were questioned, Sarah Good said, you know, no way was she a witch. Sarah Osborne said exactly the same thing, but one of them questioned whether the other one was possibly a witch. And so that helped to lead to concerns in the community about witchcraft. And I might add that by now, the young daughter of Thomas Putnam Jr., who was a strong supporter of Samuel Parris in the church, his young daughter, Anne, had joined in the accusations. It's not clear exactly how soon she joined in the accusations. This has, again, to do with the fact that we just don't have any detailed information about what went on between the middle of January and the end of February. But in any event, she is listed on the initial court documents of accusations. Now, what happened initially is that two local magistrates from Salem Town came out to Salem Village to conduct the interrogations of these people. These were what we would might call preliminary examinations. This is not a trial or anything like that. This is the magistrates questioning these three women who are the first to be accused.
You're right that scholars have come to very different conclusions as to why things unfolded the way they did, and especially why these girls acted the way they did. Poisoning, disease, emotional issues have all been thrown around. I know it's speculation, but what do you believe about all of that?
I think there's a real difference between the initial people, the initial young children who are afflicted, and some of the later people. I regard what happened to the young children and the initial accusations as very much in line with the pattern that I already mentioned. That is, young children in intensely Puritan households becoming overwhelmed by the Puritan idea, basically, that everyone is damned to hell unless they've been saved by Christ, and you cannot know whether you're saved or not, which is a source of deep anxiety for Puritans in the 17th century, and clearly very deep anxiety for young children. So I think that's what I think is the answer for the first accusers. Later on, as I argue in the book, there are, I think, other reasons. And that's when the crisis expands. I point out in the book that people have tended not to pay attention to the chronology of events. The initial accusations in Salem Village are relatively limited and are actually not unprecedented in New England. There's a previous incident in Hartford, Connecticut in the 1660s, in which about as many people are accused, and that's in about the same time period. But what happens in Salem Village, or what happens in northern New England, is that the whole situation explodes and gets completely out of control in the middle of April of 1692, and that's when I think different things enter into it, and in particular the trauma of the Indian Wars on the northern frontier, because we begin to see accusations from young women in Salem Village who are not actually from Salem Village. They are refugees from the main frontier. They're working in Salem Village as servants, one of them in the household of the Putnams, and they begin to join in with the accusations, and that's when everything really blows up.
How do you think these girls chose their victims? There was such a wide range of people accused of witchcraft. Women, a few men, some religious, members of the church, rich, poor. It seems so random, but do you think there was some method to the madness?
I came to the conclusion, as a result of working on the book, it certainly was not something I thought of before I worked on the book, before I worked my way through all the records. I came to the conclusion that every New England village at the time had its rumored local witch. That gossip, which was incredibly pervasive. Remember, this is a period in which there are no newspapers, and there's no way of spreading information other than talking to people. And one of the things that you see in the Salem records is that people talk to each other all the time, and they spread stories about strange events. And when 17th century people needed to explain strange events, they often turned to witchcraft as their default explanation. And so many people in these villages, and they came from a wide variety of backgrounds, as you said, came to be seen, some of them church members, some of them not church members, but came to be seen by their neighbors as witches or potential witches. And this included prominent men who were involved in the Indian Wars for one reason or another. For example, I discovered that one of the men who was accused was a militia leader who was extremely incompetent, and a lot of men who had been under his command were killed, so that there was a good reason for people to suspect that he was not entirely on the up and up. One of the things we haven't talked about yet is the fact that the Indians were seen as creatures of the devil, or as devil worshippers at this time. And so when the explosion occurred after the middle of April of 1692, the explosion of accusations, it was fairly easy for people to see Indians and the witches in league with each other as allies, attacking New England, with the witches working in the invisible world and the Indians working in the visible world. And to people at that time, the invisible world was just as real as the visible world. This is a period before the Enlightenment. This is a period before the scientific revolution. This is a period before anybody understands anything about germs, about the origins of diseases. When somebody's child was fine one day, or seemingly fine one day and sick the next day and dead 3 days later, people had no explanation for it. Sometimes they said it was witchcraft because they'd had this quarrel with some neighbor who had cussed them out for one reason or another and had said, "You better watch out, I'll get you." And then they see that when the child dies a month or 2 months later or whatever, they begin to see a connection between the two events. I mean, I think that people, even today, we want to have causation for major things. We want to understand what the causes are. We may understand germs today, but we don't understand other things. I would put sort of modern conspiracy theories about, you know, the death of JFK or the death of somebody else, as that it can't have just been sort of random. It can't have been one lone gunman. It has to have been a giant conspiracy, sort of along the same lines as what was the way that people thought in the 17th century about witchcraft, or about the potential for witchcraft. So I think that the people came to the conclusion that there was this giant conspiracy of witches and Indians against pious New England. And this went on for months.
And now a quick word from our sponsor.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day, 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies?
Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906. When a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilly, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
And now, back to the show. Some of the imagery that these girls concocted, pretty gruesome, pretty nightmarish. The idea of being roasted alive on a spit, this image of a spectral black man comes up frequently.
Yes.
Where do you think that image originated?
Well, one of the things I discovered is that the people at the time described Indian skin tone as black. And so when the spectral black man is discussed, other people have interpreted that as a man wearing black clothing. But I interpret it as very much the image of an Indian. In people's spectral visions. And you're right about the image of someone being roasted on a spit, but that was something that was known to people who had been captured by the Indians, or stories of people who'd been captured by the Indians being tortured in that way. And these stories were widespread in New England at the time. I might add here that I said earlier that one of the things that I did was to try to read widely in letters at the time, not just in letters that had to do with witchcraft. And one of the things I discovered was in letters that were written to England and written to friends in other colonies was a lot of information about what was going on in the Indian Wars and who had been killed and the depredations that Indian raids had caused on various farms and various towns. So this information was fairly widespread and frequently shared. And so people were constantly, I think, afraid. And you can see this. It's all over the records. For example, Sarah Osborne says in her response to the accusation that she is more likely to have been bewitched than to be a witch because she herself had had nightmares of being attacked by Indians.
How many people are eventually accused?
There are different ways of counting the number of people who are accused. I tend to go specifically for the people who we have explicit court records about. And that gets you up to about 150 people formally accused. Some people instead count the number of people who are named in recorded accusations, even if no charges are pursued against them. And you can get up to about double that number when you do that. You get up to around 300 people who are named in accusations at some point, you know, whose name is thrown out, even if the authorities never explicitly pursue a complaint against them. And basically, things exploded really dramatically. I have a chart in the book where I show the chart of the increasing number of accusations. The first explosion comes after a young girl who is a refugee from the frontier says she confesses to being a witch. Her name is Abigail Hobbs. She confesses to being a witch. This is in the middle of April. And says that the devil recruited her in the woods outside her home in Maine. And that was just at the time the Indian War was restarting in 1688. That's when she was recruited. And after that, you get a huge explosion of accusations. And then another explosion, that's in April to May. And then another huge explosion after the new governor arrives with the new charter in the middle of May. And then it's sort of, there's a lull. It doesn't go on consistently. There's a kind of a lull. And certainly, especially after the first trial and the first hanging, and that occurs in early June. But then in July, the accusations start up again at a major pace. And that's actually when the accusations move away from the context of Salem Village and Salem Town and to the neighboring town of Andover, where many people confess and name other people as their witch allies. I mean, it's a very dramatically different situation from Salem Village itself, or from Salem itself. But you asked, how did people know about other people who might be named as witches, or to name as witches? And I think gossip did it. I mean, the people in Salem Village who were the core, I call them the core group of accusers, they were very well attuned to the gossip networks. And so they may never have personally known many of the people they accused. In fact, most of the people they accused, they didn't know. But these were people who, when you investigate the situation, were the people who were, in fact, accused and known in their villages as the local witch. I once had a student who investigated this very specifically about the accusation of someone in the community of Amesbury, which is quite a ways away from Salem, at least by 17th century standards. It was, you know, 20, 30 miles. And she discovered that one of the accusers of this woman in Amesbury was related closely to someone in Salem Village. And so all we had to do was posit a random conversation between those two people at some point, and then the accusers in Salem Village picking up on that gossip and then accusing that person, accusing the person in Amesbury. So all you need is a gossip chain to show where the accusers in Salem Village got the names of people from all over northern New England who they would accuse of being witches. But of course, they also knew people themselves. Because as I said, a number of them were refugees from the Maine frontier. And they knew some of these people that they then accused personally when they were in Maine. I might add here that this is a story from my research. When I first began to realize, and it was not something that I started off the research with, when I first began to realize how important the Maine connection was, I went looking for sources on Maine in the 1680s and 1690s, nothing I'd ever looked at before. And I remember vividly finding something called the Documentary History of the State of Maine, which was produced in the 19th century by Maine authorities. And I sat down to look at these pages in my study in the Cornell Library, and my jaw dropped. In records from the late 1680s and early 1690s, there were all these names that were familiar to me from the Salem records. It was one of the great revelatory moments of my career as a historian. I was literally blown away by the fact that all these people I've been reading about in 1692 records, all or a lot of them, knew each other from Maine from 1688 on.
Well, that's incredible. I'll bet a few of my listeners out there might be wondering this. You mentioned that many of the people accused of being witches would ultimately confess to it. They were certainly under enormous pressure to confess. But can you talk about this phenomenon, why people were admitting they were witches when they were in fact not?
Right. Well, that's a very good question, and it's one that a lot of historians have addressed, because it does raise all kinds of questions. But of course, as we know, even today, people under tremendous pressure to confess from authorities sometimes confess to things they didn't do. And the same thing is true in the 17th century. People confess to being witches. This was a very highly hierarchical society. Young people in particular were told to defer to their elders. Older people of ordinary status were told to defer to magistrates and ministers. And when magistrates and ministers came to ordinary people and said, "We know you are witches. It's time for you to confess and save your souls," some people did. Other people resisted, but a number of people did. And then they named other people too. Now, one of the patterns that I discovered that was fascinating was that in Andover, where you do get a lot of people confessing to being witches and naming other family members as witches in some cases, the people who were more likely to do that were the younger people. I discovered that older people who confessed to being witches were usually very careful about who they implicated along with themselves. That is, they implicated, especially later in the crisis, after a number of people had been hanged, they implicated only people who were already dead, or they implicated people who had been accused by other people, and they were not the first to accuse them. It was younger people, and there were many younger people in Andover who were put under tremendous pressure to confess, who just spewed out a lot of names, and they became the first people to then accuse those persons. So it varied. But some people actually, when they took their confessions back, because some women in particular took their confessions back, said when they were doing that, said, well, in one case, I remember specifically, a woman said, well, my brother-in-law told me I had to be a witch because of X. And I decided that he was probably right, that I maybe had become a witch unwittingly. And I hadn't really understood that in my discontent with my circumstances a week or two earlier or whenever, I don't remember exactly what she said, that I had unwittingly become a witch. So some people were actually convinced they were witches. Now, remember, also, I talked about fortune telling. One of the most interesting cases is a man who confessed to being a witch, and he was a fortune teller. He was someone who was well known as a fortune teller. And he confessed to being a witch, and then he took it back. And he, at his trial, or at his grand jury hearing, he took back the confession that he had given originally to the magistrates. And he said, it kind of doesn't matter. I know I'm going to die regardless. And he did. He was the only person hanged who had confessed to being a witch. The other reason that some people, that scholars, including myself, think that people were willing to confess to being witches is that especially by later in the period, that is by the late, by August and September of 1692, they began to realize that confessed witches were not being hanged. They were being kept alive to testify against other accused witches. So it's actually not until the last set of trials before the court of Oyer and Terminer, which is in September of 1692, that people who were confessors were tried for being witches. In fact, that's when Abigail Hobbs is tried, is in September of 1692, because there began to be pressure on the court to try people who confessed, because up to then they'd only been trying people who wouldn't confess and hanging them.
Interesting. What were some of the tactics used to pressure the accused to confess?
Well, we don't know that much. There is some evidence of keeping someone sleepless, not allowing them to sleep, of, as I said, the kind of pressure of a major person saying, "I know you're a witch, you must confess," that sort of thing, a relative or a important minister or an important magistrate. There is one story of two young men being tortured by being tied neck and heels, was the phrase, basically with their hands tied behind their backs to their ankles in an extremely uncomfortable position until it was said blood came out of their noses and they agreed to confess. But for the most part, I think it's more psychological torture than physical torture.
So there were so many victims in these events. So many individual stories, far too many for us to even come close to touching today. And of course, listeners interested in reading about them can buy your book. But is there any particularly poignant story that comes to mind, one that especially touched you as you were writing this book so long ago?
That's an interesting question. I haven't been asked that before. I think what I would respond to that is my own ninth great-great-step grandmother, Susanna Martin, who was not my biological ancestor, but was a woman who married my biological ninth great-grandfather when the baby that became my eighth great-grandmother was a baby. I mean, they married when she was only a couple of months old. Clearly, Mr. Martin needed a wife for his child, and he married Susanna. She was one of the people in Amesbury who was long accused of being a witch. And she had actually been tried before and had been acquitted, or at least cleared without enough evidence against her. And she was hanged. An actual direct ancestor of mine, Mary Bradbury, was accused of being a witch, was actually convicted of being a witch, but was not hanged. Her husband was a prominent magistrate, actually, and he convinced the governor to reprieve her. She was reprieved, and so she survived until the end of the special court of Oyer and Terminer. The court was dissolved. The family also had money, and I'm convinced that the Boston jailer, a lot of these people were jailed in Boston, by the way. There wasn't enough room in Salem jail to hold them all, and they were sent off other places, and a bunch of them to Boston. And I'm convinced that the Boston jailer had his hand out for bribes, because a number of prominent people who were jailed in Boston, including this particular great-grandmother of mine, mysteriously escaped from jail. And I think that the Boston jailer was taking bribes to let them go. It was only the prominent people who got away, only the people with money. And they fled the colony and didn't return until months later, when basically the crisis was over. But she was also someone else, but she was not hanged, unlike Susanna Martin. And I might say to your listeners that one of the things I always do when I go to Salem, and I do go to Salem relatively frequently, sometimes I've taken students there, is I visit the very moving memorial to the people who were executed it's right in the middle of downtown Salem, adjacent to the cemetery where a couple of the judges, I might add, are buried. In this very fine, small memorial, there is a bench for each of the people who was convicted and hanged. And every time I go, I always make sure I put something, some kind of a tribute, a flower, or a votive candle on the bench of Susanna Martin.
There is one thing that I want to ask you about, because it's become an almost mythological aspect to these events, the witch cake.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what this was and its significance to the story?
Yes, one of the stories early on is that Mary Sibley, who was a local person in Salem Village, instructed either Tituba and her husband, who is known as Indian John, we don't really know anything about him at all, or both of them together, to make a witch cake. And a witch cake was a cake made of some kind of grain and the urine of the afflicted person, and it's baked in the oven and then it's fed to a dog. And this was a traditional English remedy, or not remedy exactly, but a witch finding tool in England, because the idea was that somehow the witch would then emerge in some way after the witch cake was fed to the dog. I mean, it is a very strange argument. But it was, in fact, after that Tituba was accused of being a witch. And it's not voodoo or anything. It is a traditional English thing. And Samuel Parris got very angry at Mary Sibley for having done this. And he excoriated her in front of the congregation at Salem Village Church after it came out that she had done this, because he said she had gone to the devil to find the devil, and that was inappropriate.
Would I be correct in stating that of all of the afflicted girls involved in the accusations, that it was Ann Putnam that accused more people than anyone else of being witches?
Ann Putnam was definitely responsible, and she, of course, later on apologized formally to the church when she tried to join the church. She never married. I think that it sort of destroyed her marriageability. In fact, one of the things I discovered as I investigated the fate of all the afflicted people who were younger, that they tended to marry much later. The other young women who were the afflicted accusers tended to marry much later than other women at the time. So they were not desirable wives or wives to be. She was indeed responsible for many, but I actually think that Mercy Lewis, who was the main refugee servant in the household of the Putnams, was probably more responsible. She was older, but she also clearly, to my mind, had PTSD. That's one of the things I argue in the book, is that these refugees, these girls who were refugees from the main frontier, had PTSD, what we would today call PTSD. And I think that Mercy Lewis, I would actually put more onus on Mercy Lewis. She was older. She was mentally unstable, however. So how much you blame her for that, for the traumatic experiences of her childhood in Maine, which, by the way, I do detail in the book, how much you can blame her for that is not clear. But if you're thinking about who's responsible for the most deaths, I think it's probably Mercy Lewis.
All of the executions were by hanging?
Yes. The formal executions, yes. Now, in the famous case of Giles Corey, he was pressed to death by heavy stones, but that was not intended to be an execution. It worked out that way because he resisted doing what he was supposed to do. And there was a ritual in the 17th century in which someone would be called up before the court, and they would be asked to plead guilty or not guilty. And Giles Corey pleaded not guilty. And then there was a ritual question that he had to answer. And the ritual question was, how will you be tried? And he was supposed to say, by God and my country. He refused to say that. And so the magistrates decided to use an ancient English, going back to medieval times, an ancient English torture, which was placing heavy stones on his body until he would say that. And he absolutely refused. And so he died. There's no other way to describe it. He died. And so he was an irascible guy. Sometimes in stories of Salem witchcraft, he comes off as a hero. But in fact, he had 15 or 18 years earlier, I can't remember exactly when, had been accused with great reason of having beaten a servant to death. This guy is not a nice man. And he refused. And so a lot of people say, wondering, why did he do this? Why did he not do it? Well, he knew he was going to be hanged regardless, because at that time, everybody who had been convicted had been hanged. Everybody up before the court had been convicted and everybody had been hanged. So he knew what his fate would be. And so some people basically said he was just an irascible old guy who refused to cooperate. Other people say he was trying to protect his property from being confiscated, which it could have been if he had been convicted and hanged as a witch. It's just not clear.
Where does this come from, the stories of witches being burned at the stake?
There were witches who were burned to death in Europe, but no witches were ever burned in Salem. No witches were ever burned in England. That was not the penalty for witchcraft in a Protestant society. In Catholic societies, there were witches who were burned, and that's basically the story in some cases in the European continent, especially in the 15th and 16th centuries. I might say here that the incidents in Salem are the very end of witchcraft prosecutions and accusations in the Western world. There is one slightly later incident in Scotland, by which I mean a few years later in the 1690s, and that's it. There are no other witchcraft incidents in the Western world, but there were a lot of them in the 15th and 16th centuries in continental Europe, especially in Switzerland and Germany, did lead to executions by fire, but that never happened in America or England.
Was there ever any evidence that any of the people accused of witchcraft were actual active witches participating in witchcraft?
It depends on how you define witchcraft. If you define witchcraft the way the magistrates did, yes, there was, because there were fortune tellers. Yes, there was, because there were people who cast spells to try to help young women find the husband they wanted or something like that. If you define witchcraft as trying to harm someone, maybe. There is some slight evidence in some cases, it depends on how you interpret it, that somebody might have pushed pins into what was called a poppet. That is we might call it a puppet or a doll of some sort. Someone making an image of someone they hated and saying, you know, and pushing a pin into them while giving a curse to try to get this, to try to hurt that person in some way. We do have evidence of that, or at least accusations of that. And there's, in one case, there was something that purported to be a poppet that was found in a, quote, witch's house. But it's really unclear. There is one scholar, I might add, who has argued that there were people really practicing witchcraft. But I would go back to my statement that it depends on how you define what witchcraft is. And people disagreed about what witchcraft was when it came right down to it.
How long did it take for people in the community to realize the errors of their ways? When did that realization happen, that these people were dealt a terrible hand?
Well, it depends on how you define people and how you define community. The court of Oyer and Terminer, which was the special court that was set up by the governor, began to try cases in June and ended in September. The governor dissolved the court in October after there were a lot of complaints about the court and the way that it was dealing with evidence. I think a lot of that had to do with the way the trials in September were conducted, where some of the verdicts were seen as more dubious than others in the previous time period. And they were really whipping people through in September, shall we say. And then there were 8 people hanged in late September. And I think that helped to bring about complaints about the court and the court's process. And what we would take today, maybe call opinion leaders in Boston, who began to question what was happening. A prominent minister questioned what was going on. A major kind of a prominent business figure began to question what was going on. And they circulated written accusations or written statements questioning the court process and so forth. I might add here that nobody really questioned the reality of witchcraft. What they were questioning was the legal procedures that were used to convict people of witchcraft, the use of spectral evidence in the courtroom, that is, the use of the accusers coming in and claiming that they were being afflicted by witches in the presence of the court. I mean, some people said, wait a minute, why would a witch be so stupid as to afflict people in the presence of the court while that person is on trial? I mean, how does that make any sense? And so there were people who used, shall we say, logic and reason to question what was going on. One person who wrote to a friend of his who was a magistrate said, "This evidence is coming from the devil. We cannot trust the devil. We know from the Bible that the devil is a deceiver. That's what the Bible tells us." So when there are people who are being afflicted in the courtroom, that's the devil doing that. So we can't trust them. So that's a very excellent 17th century way of arguing against what was going on. In the end, 5 years down the road, some of the jurors apologized and one of the judges apologized. And then 10 years down the road, the colony of Massachusetts began to compensate the families of the accused, of the convicted, and also to compensate people who themselves had been held in jail for a while but had not themselves been convicted. They had ultimately been freed. And some of this stuff went on until about the middle of the 18th century, until I think the last one I know about is 1748, there were descendants of one of the convicted men who were still asking for compensation for their relatives' estate.
So I do have one final question for you.
Sure.
The term witch hunt is thrown about pretty casually in politics these days.
Yes.
I would love it if you could tell us your thoughts on that.
Yes. Well, you know, our president today says that he's the subject of the greatest witch hunt in American history. This is not true. The greatest witch hunt in American history is indeed Salem in 1692. But the reason that he does that is because the phrase witch hunt has come to mean something that is inappropriate, something that is inaccurate. We now know that people in Salem in 1692 were not really witches. We know this was a mistake. And so whenever he or anyone else today or in the past, as with the McCarthy period in the 1950s, said it's a witch hunt, the implication is that the people who are being accused are innocent. And that's, I think, what he's trying to get Americans today to think, is that he is innocent, just like the witches of 1692.
Well, this has been wonderful. So your book is available online and in bookstores.
Yes, my book is in paperback with Vintage. It can be purchased through Amazon or in any bookstore. And it's also available in libraries. You don't have to buy it to read it. Although I'd like it if you bought it.
And you mentioned that you just recently finished a new book. Would you mind telling us about that?
Yes, my new book, which will be published in middle of February, it is about the American Revolution, and it's called 1774, The Long Year of Revolution. It's a study of the events between the Boston Tea Party of December 1773 and the outbreak of fighting at Lexington and Concord in April of 1775, and it deals with all the colonies, with events in all the colonies. Usually anything that focuses on this period concentrates solely or almost solely on Massachusetts. My book deals with all the colonies and what's going on in political discourse throughout the year 1774, all the way from Maine to Georgia.
Well, that's exciting. I can't wait to read that. Well, thank you again for your time.
Sure. Always glad to talk about witchcraft.
Again, my guest today has been Mary Beth Norton, author of In the Devil's Snare, The Salem Witchcraft Crisis of 1692. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.